Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to the program. My guest today is Michael Clare, a professor of peace and world security studies at five different colleges in the US, Amherst College, Hampshire College, Mount College, Smith College, and the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Before assuming his current post in 1985, Professor Clare served as a fellow and program director of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Michael Clare has written widely on U.S. foreign policy, the arms trade, and international resource politics. He is the author or co-author of 9 books, including Resource Wars, 2001, Blood and Oil, 2004, and his recent book, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, 2008, by Holt. Clare has also written for many newspapers and journals, including Current History, Foreign Affairs, Harper's, The Nation, Newsweek, and Scientific American. Michael Clare, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Well, it's just great to be with you, Helen.
Thank you, Michael. Now, look, this is a subject I haven't dwelt too much upon, but it's emerging rapidly, I think, sort of without the obvious consciousness of many people in the world. And it's really quite scary. We're feeling it in Australia, but you describe China as a shopaholic of planet Earth, while the United States currently, because of the recession, is staying at home. Would you like to enlarge upon that, Michael?
Well, you know, China, everybody knows, I'm sure people in Australia are very well aware of China's rise as a great economic power, and in its rise, China is building up its industries, its infrastructure, and acquiring all that goes with that, new cities, expanding its cities, highways, railroads, and all this requires tremendous amount of resources. So it's going around the world acquiring the natural resources you need to make this happen, iron ore, coal, copper, and a lot of oil in particular, because China's now the world's largest automobile market. All those cars need oil. So China is scrambling around the world, scouring the world to acquire oil and all these other resources. And, of course, Australia is one of those places where the Chinese have gone in particular looking for minerals and natural gas. So what I've been following is the degree to which China has used its wealth, its accumulated wealth, to buy these resource assets around the world, to position itself to be increasingly able to support itself with resource assets under its control. So it's buying oil wells, it's buying natural gas fields, it's buying copper mines and iron mines in Asia and Africa and Latin America and the Middle East, everywhere. And this is a matter of concern for the United States because in many cases, these countries are formerly allies or trading partners of the United States and its allies, places that have long been in the Western orbit, that are now moving into the Chinese orbit. And this is the kind of thing that makes American leaders very nervous, especially when it's countries like Iran or Venezuela that have taken an anti-American position. So we're talking not only about an economic issue, and this certainly is part of the shift in economic power from West to East, but it also has geopolitical and military implications.
Do you think that the leaders currently in the United States, both in the House, Senate, and the White House, State Department, are particularly aware of this situation, Michael, or do you think they're so currently bound up by the domestic agenda and what is happening with various political entities in the states that they this is sort of under their radar screen to a degree?
Oh, no, this is something I think that they're very aware of. Now, Helen, you do say that the president has been preoccupied, of course, with domestic issues, the health care debate, and that's true. But certainly senior members of his staff and the Department of State, the Department of Defense, are very much concerned about the geopolitical implications of China's resource acquisitions around the world. And a lot of what the State Department and the Defense Department do is to seek alliances and other diplomatic means of countering China's activities. Just to give one example, the United States has created a new military command in Africa, the Africa Command. And this has only been established in 2008. And I think this is a reflection of growing U.S. concern about, on one hand, America's dependence on African oil, but also concern about China's growing presence in Africa.
Yes, I wondered about that. It's called AFRICOM, and I didn't quite understand the projection of power and why they were doing it. But it's very clear that Africa is a huge resource commodity, if you would put it that way, and open, I think, for great exploitation. And so obviously America would move in with its military power in the light of where China is at the moment. And then you talk about weapons sales by China and Russia and America to many, many countries in the pursuit of these natural resources. Would you like to address that issue, Michael?
Yes. You know, in their pursuit of these resource assets, both the United States and China want to form very close relationships with the governments that control these assets, whether it's an oil-producing country or a major mineral producer. Both sides want to have very close relationship with the government so they could count on getting access to those resources. And very often what those governments want, if we're talking about Sudan or Nigeria, Angola, often what they want is weaponry. They want the weapons to help keep themselves in power, because very often these governments are contested by their own population for one reason or another. So as part of the effort to cement ties with these resource-supplying countries, the U.S. and China offer them weapons. Not only weapons, but military training, military technological support, military intelligence support. And this can take on a competitive nature where the U.S. and China are both providing arms to the same country, as in Nigeria or Kazakhstan, cases where the U.S. and China are both supplying weapons and military support in a competitive drive to establish ties with an energy supplying country.
Yes, and many of the governments of these countries are corrupt, right?
Oh, yes. Oil production is a natural invitation to corruption. There's a term for this in the academic literature, Helen. It's the resource curse. And it's a consistent pattern of corruption, because oil is so lucrative, it produces so much wealth that it attracts people, in the literature, rent seekers. The wealth coming from the production of oil is the royalties, and the revenues are called rents. And you have various individuals or royal families or cliques or clans that seek to monopolize the collection of rents from the production of oil and to pass it down to their sons, to their cronies, and so they perpetuate themselves. They use the military and the police to remain in power. So corruption is almost always present when you have oil production in these developing countries where there's no other source of wealth.
So let's take Myanmar or Burma as a classic example. My brother was a diplomat there decades ago, and it's just been so incredibly corrupt, run by the military, Nguyen and others, for so long. And I only learnt the other day, and it makes obvious sense, that Myanmar is absolutely chock-a-block full of natural resources, including oil. Would you like to expand on that, Michael?
Well, yes, Burma does have a lot of resources. It has a lot of natural gas in particular that's of interest to foreign powers. The natural gas, a lot of it is in the Andaman Sea, the water off the shore of Burma or Myanmar, as they call themselves. And there was a great deal of interest in acquiring that by American companies, particularly the Unocal Corporation, which had the contract, the concession to acquire Burma's natural gas and built a pipeline across Burma to Thailand where there was a market for it. And there are many allegations that the Burmese, because this pipeline went through areas that were occupied by minority peoples, the Karen peoples, that they brought in the army to basically use the scorched earth policy. They used slave labor. And so American corporations were accused of participating in egregious human rights practices. And this was brought before American courts. And they had to pay damages, I believe. Eventually, this was Unocal's properties were acquired by Chevron Corporation, and they've been exempted from some of the other penalties that have been imposed on Burma because they're such great value.
Oh dear.
Now, China wants to become a leading energy producer in Burma and is doing everything it possibly it can to woo Burmese leaders, providing arms, economic assistance. And the Chinese are going to build the pipeline across Burma to bring oil from the Persian Gulf across Burma into China. So there's a lot of Chinese investment now in Burma.
Yes, and then if you think about sending natural gas to Thailand, Thailand is in a mess at the moment too with Shaksun Sinawat and his support by the population. I don't quite understand what is going on in Thailand, but there's a tremendous uprising, and it must be partly about energy and the resources that it's dealing with. Is that correct?
Well, this is not something that I know enough about to comment, I'm afraid. Thailand is a big energy consumer, and there is some production in the Gulf of Thailand, but I can't say more than that.
No. So when we look at the papers and the slaughter going on in Sudan and the Congo and in many countries of Africa, do you think that the main dynamic behind this is what you have just described, Michael Clare, the race for resources, corrupt governments and who keep their population subdued, and the weapons and arms trade. Do you think it's mostly about that, or is it about other things, tribal competition and the like?
Well, always there are ethnic differences involved, but I think that those are always manipulated by warlords and corporations and other parties that seek to exploit the resource assets of these countries. Yes, of course, they will try to whip up ethnic differences as a way of recruiting people into warlord armies to, you know, to get foot soldiers for whatever conflicts are taking place. And historically, there may have been ethnic clashes over the division of water supplies or something like that. But I would say that most of what we read about in the newspapers when it's taking place in Africa or in the Middle East, that resources are at the root of it, a competition for control of the resources or the wealth that the resources generate. You have to distinguish between those two. Most of the oil and the diamonds and the iron ore that's produced in Africa is not used by the people in Africa. They see no benefit from the diamonds. It's who controls the wealth that's generated by the export of those materials to Europeans and Americans and Chinese and Japanese. It's warlordism and corrupt governments all jockeying for control over the distribution of these precious resources.
Yes. So there are three categories of resources, really. There's the fossil fuel, the oil, and the natural gas. And then the minerals, iron, copper, uranium, aluminium, and the like. And then there's land and water. So you say, Michael Clare, that China began gobbling up foreign energy assets in Angola, Iran, Kazakhstan, Nigeria, Sudan, and Venezuela. And you say on the whole, these acquisitions were still dwarfed by those being made by giant Western firms like ExxonMobil, Chevron, Royal Dutch Shell, and BP. But this is something new, and you refer to the growing Chinese presence in a universe once dominated by Western majors. And I think that probably Iraq would be a good illustration of what this really means. Do you think, Michael Clare, that America went into Iraq largely because it contains one-third of the oil resources of the world?
Well, Helen, actually, it's not. Iraq has about a tenth of the world's resources.
Yeah.
But the region as a whole, the Persian Gulf region, has about two-thirds. And I think you can't separate one from the other. I think that the U.S. went into Iraq because it's a key player in a region that has two-thirds of the world's oil. So it was a strategic or a geopolitical move. That's what I believe, that it is U.S. policy. It's the declarative policy of the United States. It's known as the Carter Doctrine, that says the United States will not allow another power to come to arise in the Persian Gulf area that will threaten the flow of oil from the Persian Gulf to the West. I'm paraphrasing, but that's the essence of the Carter Doctrine. And Saddam Hussein was viewed as a threat to American domination of the Persian Gulf and all of its oil. And it was to ensure American dominance of the entire Gulf that the United States invaded Iraq, to ensure that no other rival to American dominance would ever arise. And that's the essence of the current U.S. crisis with Iran, because the Iranians are challenging American dominance in the Persian Gulf. And I fear that this, too, will lead to a clash.
So they're just using the uranium enrichment situation, which Israel is very worried about, to basically get at the resources of Iran and the Persian Gulf, rather than being specifically, I know they are worried about that, but specifically worried about the uranium enrichment situation. in Iran?
Well, yeah. I mean, the Iran's pursuit of nuclear enrichment is worrisome to the United States on several grounds. On one ground, it raises Iran's profile in the region, and that makes everybody very worried. And secondly, if Iran were to acquire nuclear weapons, it would make it much harder for the United States to invade and occupy Iran the way it did Iraq.
And do you think that's on the agenda? Do you think that's, you know, do you think the Pentagon is actually discussing invading Iran?
Oh, I certainly think that that has been on the agenda in the past. When President Bush spoke of the axis of evil, that he mentioned Iran among the nations that were viewed as a threat to the United States at that time. So, yes, I think that a war between the U.S. and Iran was being considered as what the military would call a contingency, not a inevitability, but a contingency. And they plan for all such contingencies.
Continuously. I'm interviewing Michael Clare today, who's an author and professor of peace and world security studies in five colleges in Massachusetts. So we in Australia, Michael, are very much aware of the Chinese presence because Australia is a very ancient continent, as you would know, and it's been eroded such that we have giant mountains of iron ore. We have huge amounts of bauxite, which is used for aluminium. You call it aluminium. We have 40% of the world's richest uranium. And what we're observing, because of sort of globalization and how the economics of the world operates, the Chinese are coming in and buying up shares in companies either owned by Australian corporations or by British and other corporations. And there's a sort of feeling in government and people who are aware that this is scary because China, without having a war or occupying Australia like the Japanese wanted to do in the Second World War, could actually end up owning much of the Australian wealth and resources. Would you like to comment about that, Michael Clare?
Okay. Well, first of all, let me say that I'm not an Australian, so it's inappropriate for me to speak about what Australians should and should not do. So I'm just giving you my my observation from a distance.
Yes, we'd appreciate that.
Okay. So having said that, one thing to begin with that concerns me is the degree to which Australia, the economy of Australia is becoming dependent on the exploitation of its natural resources, you know, as the driving factor in the economy. First of all, these resources are not going to last forever. And secondly, you know, to what degree does this generate other economic activities in the economy, or is Australia just becoming a third world country, a banana republic that's just a source of resources for somebody else, whether it's China or somebody else?
We are, so, yes. We're a third world country. We export raw materials and import finished goods, mostly from China now. So,
there's that concern. If I were an Australian, I would worry about the excessive dependence of the economy on raw material exports. But again, I'm an observer, so it may look different on the ground. I know that this has generated employment for Australians at a time when my country has 10% unemployment or more, and Australia has a lower rate of unemployment. So maybe if I were in Australia, it would look different. But yeah. I'm making that observation,
yes.
Number one.
Yeah.
That said, If I were Australian, I think I would be concerned about the degree to which one, any single country was acquiring control over so much of the natural resources that form such a large part of the economy.
Yes, we used to be worried about Japan because during the height of, you know, the the global economic riches, Japan was buying up a lot of real estate and some of our natural resources. But now, of course, it's rapidly being eclipsed by China. I'd like to get in. We've sort of covered fossil fuels, and we haven't mentioned all the countries that are involved, like Ecuador and Venezuela and Kazakhstan, and we've mentioned Iraq. And then we've talked about minerals, and we talked about Australia, but there are minerals all over Africa and Myanmar and other countries. And then there's land, because countries like Brazil and South Korea and India are running out of land to grow food, either for commodities to sell or to feed their people. And there's a huge amount of land really going begging, and that's not a good analogy, in Africa and other countries. Would you like to just discuss that a little bit, Michael, about how there are huge land grabs going on around the world by developed countries in developing countries and the water resources?
Yes, well, this, I think, is becoming a matter of extreme concern to many people in not only in Africa but in the Philippines, because the same thing is going on there. I suspect in Indonesia it's happening. So it's not just in Africa, but it's not just developed countries that are acquiring these huge plots of land, because some of the wealthier Middle Eastern countries, which aren't able to grow their own food, like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, are also buying large plots of land in Ethiopia and Sudan, so that they will have exclusive rights to grow food in African countries to supply their countries with food. And this is troubling on many, many levels. One level is, you use the term land is going begging, but that's not clear at all. The government comes in and says, well, this land is underused, therefore it's up for sale. But there are many people in those areas who say that they occupied that land and they have for centuries. But, you know, these are places where there isn't the same kind of title that you would have in a more developed country where the deeds are recorded. So there's some evidence of the Sudanese government or the Ethiopian government, for example, seizing land from people and turning it over to these corporations. That's deeply troubling. And then the whole issue of food being exclusively provided to foreign mouths, when people in these countries like Ethiopia, where there's a high level of starvation, to think that food is being produced there and exported to someplace else where people have basically enough money to buy food from anywhere. I find this highly unethical.
I can't really get my mind around these huge movements now for acquisition of, it's virtually countries in a way, and the natural resources, because, well, one, the resources of the world are finite. So we're going to run out sooner than later of all the resources we've been talking about. Two, we've got a massive overpopulation problem, moving from 1 billion people 200 years ago to now nearly 7 billion. So we've got an exponential growth in human beings. We've got China, who's joined the capitalist ethic with great enthusiasm and is unstoppable. We've got a huge military force in the United States, which has the capacity to actually destroy most life on Earth through its nuclear weapons, and Russia too. And then we've got another huge problem facing us all, and that's global warming. I mean, we've just been talking about acquiring oil from all these countries, and the Persian Gulf has 2/3 of the world's oil. We haven't even mentioned coal. Australia's a huge exporter of coal, and actually right at this moment, there is a Chinese coal freighter which hit the Great Barrier Reef, one of the wonders of the world, and is spilling oil as I speak and threatening the coral and the fish. But the two arguments don't seem to be conjoined. The argument about acquiring the world's fossil fuels for energy, for China, for Japan, for America, for all the countries to keep their economies growing and growing and growing. And at the same time, there are people like James Hansen and the scientists in the IPCC, International Panel on Climate Change, warning that we are at the tipping point of global warming. And unless we stop burning particularly coal, but also oil, that within 50 to 100 years, I mean, many of the world's species will become extinct, and we will be in dire straits as a species ourselves. And so those two, not arguments, but realities, don't seem to be conjoined or come together or take part in the discussion. Do you think that's true, Michael Clare?
Helen, that was a lot of topics that are more than just two. You're talking about population growth, resource scarcity, world accumulation of weapons, and global climate change. Yeah. Yes, I think all of these things are sort of mixed together and accelerating and exacerbating each other. It's hard to know where even to begin to talk about them. As I see it, the big worry in my mind is our need to acquire and consume resources. That is the underlying force here, is that we, as a species, and the countries that you talked about in particular, we keep on needing more of everything. And it is in our consumption of fossil fuels that's causing global climate change. And it's in the pursuit of resources that we create armies. So I see the nature of our consuming behavior as the central issue, that somehow that has to be brought under control, because if you don't bring that under control, none of the others will be solvable. If we don't reduce the consumption of fossil fuels, there's no hope of addressing global warming, and there's no hope of addressing the plunder of Africa and the other oil-producing countries. So how we consume, the nature of our consuming behaviors, and the kinds of decisions that societies make about the consumption of resources, in my view, is the nub.
Yes, and then that goes into global economy, because the economy, and we hear it time and again every night on the news, is dependent upon constant growth. And it's not growth
exactly.
It is growth of populations too, but growth and increasing and accumulating wealth to actually very few people in the world. And how can we rejigger the global economy? So, and this is a rather stupid question in a way, but one that has to be asked, the global economy to be not dependent upon growth and growth of human populations. I mean, these issues are at the root of it, aren't they, Michael?
Yes, they are, Helen, and unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to finish. But this is the crucial issue: is that we have to imagine new ways of living. We have to rebuild the economy around new concepts of of appropriate human living modes of existence. I'm sorry if this sounds a little bit utopian, but this is what it's going to take for humans to survive on the planet. And I'm very aware of that because I live in the United States, and it's the so-called American way of life, and your listeners have to imagine quotation marks around that, that is projected around the world through the media, through television and Hollywood, which I think is responsible for a lot of this, a lot of the problems we see, because the American way of life is the most energy-intensive, resource-intensive imaginable, with everybody having an automobile, at least one. In America, most families have two or more, and a large house with air conditioning and a swimming pool in the backyard and a million appliances, more every day. And that image of what people aspire to is spreading around the world, and as people reach middle-class status in China and India and Brazil and Mexico, they try to duplicate it. And this is unsustainable. The planet cannot survive that. So we really have to begin to think about a new image of the good way of living that's much more modest and much more light in its impact on the planet and uses fewer resources. Now, the economy will, there will be opportunities for entrepreneurs in this transition, which it has to happen. Nobody doubts that this has to happen. It must happen. There will be opportunities for entrepreneurs to develop new energy systems, new modes of transportation, new ways of living in cities that are much greener. So there will be a lot of opportunities, but it has to be based on energy efficiency and low consumption patterns. Sorry if I went on too long.
No,
but
it's really very important. This is the nub of the crux of the issue. And then last but not least is the consistent growth of the human population. Have you got, I know this is going a little far, Michael, but have you got some sort of answer about curbing the exponential increase in human population growth, which also is the nub of the issue?
Yes, but all of the evidence on that one is clear, is that when you provide more education and health care to young women, the population rate goes down.
Yeah.
And there's no other way to do it except that through that means. So as part of what I'm talking about, we do have to provide additional health care and education to young women around the world, and that will bring the population down. But our problem is not primarily population growth per se. It is the increase in the population of automobiles and giant homes and other gas-guzzling and energy-guzzling appliances, and that has to be curbed first, as I've tried to argue.
You've argued it very well, Michael. I know you must go off to catch a plane now.
Yes.
But it's been a very edifying and enlightening conversation with huge problems for us to solve, and I think the question is whether we're psychologically, spiritually, and intellectually smart enough to do this in time?
Well, I think young people that I teach in my classes all know that this is something that has to occur. They may not know how or when, but they understand that this is necessary. So I'm hopeful that they will seize the reins when they can and make it happen. And let me leave on that positive note.
That's a wonderful note to leave on. Thank you very much, Michael, for this interview.
My pleasure, and I hope we can talk again soon.
I think we will. Thank you, Michael.
Bye-bye.
My guest on If You Love This Planet today was Michael Clare, author and professor of peace and world security studies at Amherst College, Hampshire College, Mount College, Smith College, and the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. We will now be excerpting a segment of a speech I gave in Vermont at St. Michael's College in Burlington in 2010. The reason we will be playing this speech is because many corporations and governments of the world propose that one of the answers to global warming and fossil fuel use is nuclear power. This speech specifically addresses the inherent dangers, profound inherent dangers, of nuclear power, with specific reference to Vermont Yankee, an aging, dilapidated reactor in Vermont, the so-called Green State.
The Smithsonian Institute has named her as one of the most influential women of the 20th century, and she was personally nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Linus Pauling. She has written numerous publications, authored 7 books, including Nuclear Madness, Missile Envy, If You Love This Planet, and War in Heaven, written to educate the public about the militarization of space. Dr. Caldicott currently divides her time between Australia and the US, where she lectures widely on urgent issues of planetary survival, such as global warming, nuclear weapons, nuclear power, deforestation, toxic pollution, and species extinction. Tonight, the title of Dr. Caldicott's talk is In Our Backyard, The Health Risks of Nuclear Power. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Caldicott to St. Michael's College.
Good evening. I'm going to walk you through the medical implications of the nuclear fuel cycle tonight, beginning with uranium mining, because I'm very familiar with that, because 40% of the world's richest uranium happens to reside in my country, Australia. The Chinese are moving in, other multinationals are moving in, and our country's full of natural resources like mountains of iron ore and gold nuggets and you name it, because we're the most ancient continent on Earth, and we've been so eroded that all the minerals present themselves. We're a third world country. We export raw materials and we import finished goods. But we don't have nuclear power in Australia because it's too dangerous for us. We just export it to the rest of the world. So I'm going to walk you through radiation biology and the whole fuel cycle. First of all, by saying that this book, which is for sale outside, called Nuclear Power is Not the Answer, deals with the fact nuclear power causes global warming, that it's so expensive it's a totally socialist industry like the Pentagon. So in fact, you're a very socialist country because most of your taxes go to the Pentagon, which spends about $1 trillion a year on weapons. That's socialisation of killing. All the reactors were built with your money and the insurance is paid for by your money. And you've got Medicare and Medicaid and all the rest. So it's very funny that people are getting very upset saying that Obama and others are heading towards socialism. Okay, uranium has two isotopes, 235 and 238. This is the fissionable one. It's only present in 0.7% in the ore. It must be enriched to 3% for use in nuclear power, or greater than 50%, and you've got bomb-grade material. So any country that has a uranium enrichment plant can make bomb-grade material. That's why everyone's upset about Iran. Israel has the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world, which she neither confirms nor denies. And of the 26,000 hydrogen bombs in the world that stand ready to go, some of them, America and Russia own 97% of them. So in fact, the real rogue states are Russia and America, the axis of evil holding the world at nuclear ransom, and we could have a nuclear war tonight by accident, by cyber hacking or by design. Under the Article 4 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, it says that countries aren't allowed to make bombs. Only the ones that have got the bombs can keep them because they're stable and the best countries, but other countries are not allowed to have them. But it's very important that all countries have access to nuclear power and nuclear technology. And part of the nuclear technology is uranium enrichment. because you're enriching it for nuclear power. So what Iran is doing is totally legal under international law. We won't go into that at the moment. Now, uranium decays to a series of what are called daughter products, not sons, daughters. One of them is radon gas, which you're all familiar with, I think, because it's in your basements, you're a granite-type state, and granite's full of radon, and uranium, of course, because this is a daughter. And this is very carcinogenic. So men who mine uranium, and they're usually Aborigines in Australia, Indigenous people in Canada, Navajo Indians here, and the like here, 30 to 50% of them have died of lung cancer. Radium is another a daughter, which is also an alpha emitter. I'll walk you through this in a minute. Madame Curie refined radium from stirring pitch blend, which was uranium, and she was so fascinated, she used to walk around with a little bit of it in her lab coat pocket and play with it. Radium is a bone seeker, it's a calcium analog, and she died of leukemia, and so did her daughter. So way back at the beginning of the nuclear age, we were starting to see the abnormalities associated with radiation. People who live near uranium piles, they leave the piles in huge dumps called tailings of millions and millions of tons, which continually excrete radon gas, so people living near inhale it. And the radium is very water soluble, and it gets into the water, goes in the underground streams to, well, we've got a big uranium mine, Ranger, in the Northern Territory, where there are crocodiles and beautiful birds and just stunning, stunning country. But it's getting into the Magella Creek, where the Aborigines fish. And radium bioconcentrates by orders of magnitude at each step of the food chain. So you have algae, crustaceans, little fish, big fish, and us, because we're at the apex of the pyramid of the food chain. So it's very dangerous to live near uranium. There's absolutely no remediation, but there should be. They should put the tailings back where they came from. But they don't, because it's too expensive. You don't want to do something that costs money. You want to make money, but not spend it. If remediation was included in the whole nuclear fuel cycle, nuclear power would be producing huge amounts of CO2. As it is, I've been to the uranium mines. The trucks are nearly the size of this room. The height of the wheels, the tyres, go right up to the top of that screen there. They're just massive. How do you run trucks? Petrol. You call it gasoline, don't you? What does petrol make when it burns? CO2. So a huge amount of CO2 is produced with the production of uranium. And we've got 40% of the world's uranium. We've got an awful lot of it. Okay, now I have to walk you through radiation. There are basically five sorts of radiation. X-rays, hands up those in this audience who've never had an X-ray. You never have had an X-ray. What about your teeth? You don't need your teeth X-rayed every year. My ex-husband was a radiologist. They make a lot of money by irradiating you. We are the biggest irradiators of the public at the moment. CT scans give you a big dose. Fluoroscopies give you a big dose. Never have an unnecessary X-ray. Do not have your teeth X-rayed every year. Only if you've got a sore tooth or an apical abscess do you need an X-ray of your teeth. Or tooth. Radiation is cumulative. Each dose you get adds to your risk of getting cancer, and there is no dose of radiation that is safe. We live with a background radiation of about 170 millirems a year, and that's what we get from the sun and the background radiation from uranium in the earth. But under no circumstances should we add to that radiation. If you have pneumonia, you need an X-ray. The risk is minimal, the benefit's great. But don't have any unnecessary, don't go and get yourself CT scans to prove you haven't got cancer. Anyway, they don't prove you don't have cancer. Anyway, and you get a big dose. I had two CT scans the other day at the instigation of my daughter, who's a doctor, and I got a huge dose. And I said, Penny, I didn't need this. And she said, don't worry, Mum, you won't live long enough to get your cancer. That's my daughter. She loves me, I think. Now, what you need to know is after you've received radiation, if it induces cancer, it takes 5 to 60 years for the cancer to develop. That's the incubation time for cancer. If I sneeze on you, in 2 days you're sneezing. So a cold and flu is a 2-day incubation time. Measles, mumps, chickenpox, whooping cough, 3 weeks. But radiation and cancer, it's a long, silent, cryptogenic time. And that's the ace up the sleeve of the nuclear industry who says, well, no one's died. Well, first of all, they don't do the epidemiological studies around nuclear power plants to see if people are dying. And because if you do a study, well, if you don't want to find the facts and you don't want to pay compensation, don't do the study. Studies are expensive. The German government has just done a study called the KIKK study around 16 of their nuclear power plants. And they took children less than the age of 5, less than 5 kilometres from the reactor. And the incidence of leukemia in those children was more than double. And the incidence of cancer was very high. And the closer to the reactor they were, the higher the incidence of malignancy. That's a very good study, and Germans do very good studies. It's an absolute classical study. There have been very few done in this country ever. Okay, so they're X-rays, and X-rays are non-particulate. When the technician says, breathe in, hold it, and runs out of the room and goes, click, that's the instant you can be irradiated and your cells can be damaged, but you do not become radioactive. Gamma radiation is given off by uranium daughters. It's like X-rays, non-particulate, ionizing radiation. Then there's alpha radiation, which is emitted from an unstable atom composed of 2 protons and 2 neutrons. And that's particulate and it's heavy. So you can hold an alpha emitter in your hand, like uranium, and the radiation doesn't penetrate the dead layers of epidermis to hit living dermal cells. But if you inhale or ingest alpha particles, they are the most carcinogenic materials really known to the human race. Beta radiation is an electron emitted from an unstable atom. Lighter, it travels further. And then there are neutrons, which I won't really talk about now, except neutrons cause critical mass and produce what Einstein worked out, E equals mc squared. The energy produced from splitting the atom equals the mass of the atom times the speed of light squared, which is the energy released in the sun. And we've got great nuclear power in this world, and it's the sun. Okay, now how does radiation cause cancer, and what else does it cause? It does cause quite a few things, including heart disease. I won't go into that. But in all cells of the body, somatic cells, there are genes, you know that, 46 chromosomes, and there are genes to control the rate of cell division called regulatory genes. And if one of these is hit by an alpha particle, gamma, it's random. The DNA molecule is biochemically altered and sits quietly for any time from 5 to 60 years. And one day, instead of the cell dividing by mitosis in a regulated way, it goes burko and produces trillions and trillions of cells. That's a cancer. So it takes a single alpha particle to hit a single gene in a single cell to kill you. And we usually can't stop that growth. We use radiation to treat cancer. That's interesting, because cancers reproduce very fast. The cells are mitosing in an aberrant fashion, and they're very vulnerable to being killed by radiation. So we focus the beam of radiation right on the cancer, and sometimes we cure cancers, particularly childhood renal cancers. But sometimes those patients go on 20 years later to develop another primary cancer because of the radiation that hit normal cells surrounding the cancer. Well, I've had 20 years life, and that's probably worth it. The other cells in the body that are most important, though, are the eggs and the sperm that contain half the number of chromosomes and genes. And every single gene in the egg and sperm is important. That's why we are humans and not chimpanzees. 99.2%, I think, of our genes are the same as chimps. So obviously we don't understand genetics very well at all yet. We all carry several hundred genes for disease called deleterious genes for cystic fibrosis, which is my specialty. 1 in 25 Caucasians carry that gene. So in this audience, there would be quite a few carriers. It's recessive, so you don't know you've got it till you mate with someone with the same gene for cystic fibrosis. So we all carry several hundred genes for disease like diabetes, cystic fibrosis, phenylketonuria. And why do we? Because way back in evolutionary times, we're exposed to much more background radiation than now because the Earth's cooled off. And it induced mutations for disease, but also induced us. Fish developed lungs, birds developed wings, but it was a long time for evolution to evolve till this magnificent specimen appeared with its huge neocortex run by the reptilian midbrain with the opposing thumb and legs. And look what we've done to the Earth. We're very, very... I think we're an evolutionary aberrant. Actually, I shouldn't say that in a Catholic college, should I? Anyway, so... if any genes get damaged in the eggs or sperm, then you're going to increase the incidence of genetic disease. So down the time track, we're going to see epidemics of genetic diseases, and there are 2,600 now described. So talk about the unborn. This is very important. Okay, you with me now? Now, so that's how you get cancer, and that's how you get genetic abnormalities from radiation. All right, so let's go back to the nuclear fuel cycle. The uranium in Australia is crushed. The ore is crushed using more fossil fuel. It's then turned into uranium yellow cake. It's yellow. I just went, like your jacket, I just went to a uranium mine run by BHP Billiton in Western Australia on Aboriginal tribal land, of course, and they had cores from the ore itself, and you could see the uranium. It was glowed sort of greeny yellow like that, and they gave me a Geiger counter, and as we came in the bus, the Geiger counter started going tick, 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 and it went right off scale when I put it next to these cores. It's really scary. You have been listening to an excerpt from a speech I gave at St. Michael's College in Burlington, Vermont in March 2010. Thank you for listening to the program, and we'll be talking with you next week. This is Helen Caldicott signing off on If You Love This Planet.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.